Isn't it? Both in hearing from people in here, sometimes after the inquiries or in questions, and speaking with people in groups and individually, I've been touched very much by people accessing feelings or depth of understanding, states of mind, experiences, and a sense of life that they didn't know before. Accessing a new way, an expanded way of understanding one's life. And that's a big part of what we're doing here and why we're here. Having a truer, deeper, freer understanding of who we are. And I've also been amused, maybe, about how often I've been asked for the answer to some particular issue, as if it were in my power to give it. I understand this and say, and I understand that, but this other thing, and how do I do it? People have asked me in that kind of way, what should I do? I'm reminded of the famous Zen reflection, which says, death is most certain. The time of death is most uncertain. What should I do? Unless you be waiting for any more, that's the end of the reflection. That what should I do is a question not really to ask anyone else. It's a question to let deepen. Most important questions are the ones we can ask more and more deeply without looking for anything as clumsy as an answer. Notice in our restlessness, in our agitation, in our longing for something, for some solution, we notice how often we want the answer. How part of us burns to know the answer, or burns to be given the answer. We pray for answers. That whole tradition of petitionary prayer. You understand this petitionary? It means asking. Please, whether it's to a guru, or whether it's to God, or whether it's to the universe, please give me the answer. As if God's got nothing better to do than worry about my neurotic need for answers. Anything at all that I can get, I can also lose. A time, maybe, in meditation, longing for some profound experience, some illuminating experience, some experience that seems to be alluded to here, some experience that we've read about, some experience our friend had on a retreat, some experience that we had ourselves a few retreats ago that we've been desperately trying to have again. What's the deepest experience you ever had? Right now. Purposely lost. Very profound, revealing, beautiful experience. An experience that reveals something true. And the hallmark of that is, one knows it's true. It's not a nice idea, You don't have to think, oh, that's interesting. I wonder whether, does that conform with a Buddhist view, or does that, one doesn't care whether it conforms to any view or not. One knows it to be true. Knows it, not with that arrogant kind of, yes, yes, I'm right, but knows it in the depths of one's being. Yes. The hallmarks are deep knowing and a sense of awe, wonder, beauty, joy, ordinary and yet obvious. For ourselves and contact, whatever deepest sense we have of spirit. Visiting a teacher in the Himalayas, and after staying with him for some time, this must have been maybe 90, yeah. After staying for some time, when I was leaving, he said, how long have you been practicing? I told him a little bit about my practice until that time, and I was living with a hermit monk at that time for a couple of years in the Himalayas. And he said to me, call to your heart your deepest sense of life, your deepest sense that you've touched of what life's about, and let that be your guide, your touchstone, the thing you turn towards. It was a very beautiful bit of advice. But often, tragically, rather than using our deepest understanding as a way to orientate, we get hung up on the feel or the quality of the experience itself, because it's very beautiful. Some sense where the kind of tight, limited version of my life and my struggle somehow drops away into a peaceful, an expanded, a connected, a wide open sense of being. It's relieving to the soul. It's enlivening to the heart. It fades as it has to fade. Has to fade. Every experience we ever had, every experience anyone ever had, every experience the Buddha had, came, stayed a while, and went away again. That's what experience does. So if we have some great experience, and we think, oh, that's it, I just have to do that for longer periods of time. If I could just, so often people say, if I could just stay in that state, no chance of staying in any state. States of mind, yours, mine, and the Buddha's, come, hang out a bit, and go. Often on the quality of the experience, and we miss the real gift that's in there. We get hung up on how it feels. Oh, it was so nice. It was so beautiful. It was so spacious. It was so free feeling. And that's what we want back again. We want to feel good. We want to feel free. We want to feel deep. The experience may well have been something, as I say, with some sense of expansion, of freedom. That reveals, what does it reveal? It revealed that this poor old me here isn't actually the centre of the universe. This me here and my dramas and my history and my neurosis, my problems, my story, my issues, my relationships, all the things I've got to work out, aren't of great cosmic relevance. They're rather kind of petty narrow version of things. The experience reveals that, but then after it fades, good old me corrupts the experience and says, I want it back. So the very experience itself, which is expanded and freeing, has been reduced to something I can have. We've pulled that great vastness into my life, my experience. Drift of this kind of depth, this kind of profound understanding, is not the feeling quality of it. It's not how much we like it. It's the implications of it. Implications of this me not being so important are there. The invitation is to live in accordance with that. To practice living as if my issues and my problems and my wants aren't the be-all and end-all. Think of practice and practice and practice and boom, some great experience. If I practice, surely it's got to happen. But we rarely like to think of it the other way around. But some beautiful or profound experience is actually the beginning of really practicing that experience, really practicing in the light of that understanding, living the truth that we've been graced enough to see. Because, as I say, we've been through the silence, through sitting, through walking, through being quiet, through cultivating receptivity to the inner landscape and to the outer landscape and to one another, we've been looking at ourselves, looking at what arises for us, looking at the way we relate to it. And the change and the deepening understanding and the transformation that comes through that has a real power to it. But we could make the mistake of thinking of bringing the same habit pattern to our retreat experience. And thinking that my deepening, my understanding, my insights, that I'm going to get more and more insights until kaboom, the insight I'm really waiting for, and we'll turn gold, grow our earlobes. People will throw themselves at our feet. Actually, more important than what we understand about our patterns and our history and our issues, very important as those are, to the extent that they really stand in the way of us being able to settle, to cultivate some genuine steadiness, some ease of heart, some capacity to connect in a bright and caring and more important than that, more central to the issue, is the rather profound mystery of who all this is happening to. The perennial spiritual question of what does it mean to be a human being at all? What is this mystery of finding ourselves to be conscious? For there to be body. Look, extraordinary. I don't even have to think, move, and but look at that. My teacher's teacher in Thailand had a whole practice of this for hours and hours. Very serious practice for hours and hours. Monks would sit there contemplating that, eating that. It's deeply mysterious. The root of things. What makes this happen? Would help. Nothing anyone can tell us about how this happens will help. That's why I wouldn't even attempt to try. He never told me what he found out through years of doing this. But it's profoundly mysterious. The fact of finding ourselves means, what do we know? There's some knowing, there's some brightness of being, there's something. Something is a bit too much of a description, but that animates our being. Body, heart, mind, perception, feeling, seeing, connecting. And we tend to take it all for granted. We take it so quickly for granted that we reduce the whole thing and we say, it's me. As if that explained anything at all. So at the heart of genuine spiritual exploration is this perennial question: what is this? Or who am I? Or what is the nature of awareness? What is it to be conscious? What animates the being? All the same question. I'd just like to look a bit at, firstly, our erroneous views. And erroneous means wrong, stupid, foolish, misguided, deluded, erroneous views, take ourselves to be. Going from the outer to the inner. So usually we have a very familiar place that we stop thinking of the rest of the world. And we come up with something else. It's here, boundary. And everything outside of that we're rather indifferent to, even though we relate. And even though our experience, and we explored this a bit the other day in terms of connecting with others, and we talked about mudita and karuna, compassion and joy for others. Even though our experience reveals to us again and again and again, if we would only look and see, look deeply and see, that actually our sense of our being is much more expanded often than just this. But this is where we say, this is where common sense says, the rest of life stops and I begin. But if we look a little bit, if we challenge that assumption a little bit, we see that actually this, the sense of self, the sense of I, the sense of who I am, actually arises in a whole bunch of different places that don't agree with each other. I'll explain what I mean. We're coming from the outside to the inside, we get as far as the bowl. Is this who I am? No. Fairly clear. Get a little bit closer. Already here. Kind of not too sure. If someone stands that close to us, we feel like they're somehow in us a bit. Too close for comfort. No? Why? If I start here, why would I borrow something here? It's clearly, no problem. But we feel it already as they're invading me. We say, they're invading my space. My space. Like, if this is my space, what happens when I go over there? Where does it still remain my space? Sounds comic, but it is comic. It's ridiculous. Then we get to here, And easily I arises in conjunction with our body. No? We say, I'm going. Meaning, I'm dragging this lump of flesh and bones from here to there. I'm going. And then, we say, he hit me, if that's the case. Or he touched me. She looked at me. For example. No? And the sense of who we are in all those cases arises very clearly with our body, as if this body is who I am. The fact that this body is changing all the time, the fact that bits are dropping off regularly, the fact that we cut bits off every now and then, doesn't seem to worry us. If this is who I am, what does that mean for the fact that I cut pieces off regularly? The self arises not, we somehow miraculously disidentify with the body and re-identify as the owner of the body. You follow what I'm saying? My body. It's very significant what happens here. Because in our beliefs, not philosophically, but in our deep sense of who we are, has shifted. We've changed who we think we are from one thing called the body to another thing called the mind or the owner of the body. And we do this without any sense of there's been being anything bizarre about it. But we've completely changed who we take ourselves to be. From this is me, this body, to this is something I have. Therefore I'm someone else, I'm the mind, and I have a body. My body. Oh, I've got something wrong with my body. I've got issues about my body. Once you've done a few retreats, you stop thinking of my body, you get very spiritual and you talk about the body. As if talking about the body implies you're less attached to it. There's no evidence for it, but anyway. What if we saw this process completely clearly? It would shock us to the depth of our being. The implications of this are really radical, that I can take myself to be one thing, and then moments later I can take myself to be completely something, another thing, and without any sense that there's anything weird or problematic about that. And when we say my body, just to consider for a minute, where have we put the locus of self in that moment? Where is it, this thing that owns my body? This thing we call mind. Again, glibly we refer to mind that has a body. Where do we think that is? I think for some strange reason it's in here. Although, again, no, there's no evidence for it. There's just a lot of grey, squidgy stuff in there. We can't isolate. And they've even tried, scientists have even tried to find the location of consciousness. And they're still confused as to why they can't find it. Because consciousness has no location. Brain has a location. It's not the same thing. If consciousness had a location, then it wouldn't be able to go anywhere. It wouldn't be able to perceive anything beyond itself. Sometimes, the sense of I arises, not again as something different. Instead of arising as the mind, we talk about my mind. Again, shifted to something else, as if my mind is something I have. Then, who on earth do we think we are? If not body, if not mind. Other times we say, I'm angry with you. And the sense of self, again, arises in a different way. We've identified. You understand? To identify with, to put the I in, anger. I'm angry. Hi, nice to meet you, I'm angry. As if who I am is angry. But we are angry just for a short time. Then we're something else. Oh, sorry, I introduced myself wrongly before. Hi, I'm peaceful. How can it be that who I take myself to be can shift all the time? What does that mean? Does it mean that who I am is something that whips around from being the body to being the mind to being a bit of the mind to being a state of mind to being the owner of mind? Or does it mean that our whole notion of self is there in the whole universe, inner or outer, large or small, peace or wholemeal? Anywhere we hang the sense of self will get us into trouble. Anything we take ourselves to be is doomed. Doomed by death at the very least. And yet we feel ourselves actually, and there's a glimmer of truth in this. We feel ourselves to be beginningless and endless. We don't have to do great amounts of spiritual work. Naturally, we feel ourselves to be beginningless and endless. Don't we? Does that make sense when I say that? No? Please give me a sign. We feel ourselves, my sense of myself, my that thing I call Martin for some strange reason. A sense of it just extends back. I've got some story about the year I was born and all that happened to me and my disasters and everything else. But basically, my sense of my isness, my, what's it called? My sense of that stretches back. Just stretches. See, I don't know why am I doing this? Because we think it's here for some reason. It stretches back in time without me being able to find any beginning point for consciousness. No? And it stretches forward in time without me being able to conceive of any end point. Again, we have a story that we know we're going to die one day. But it just doesn't conform with our sense of our being. We identify anywhere that we, anything, anywhere, at any time that we take to be who I am, we're in trouble. I didn't say there shouldn't be any sense of I amness. I said anything in the universe that we attach that I amness to will get us into trouble. I'll explain it a bit more, hopefully. If it's not clear, please ask again. Practice this opportunity, spiritual teachings in general, ask us, beg us, for God's sake. Maybe they don't say that. please, they say. Be very suspicious of anything you take yourself to be. Challenge anything you take yourself to be. Why? Because there's the rub in life. The rub of the what I take myself to be hitting up against what I don't take myself to be. No? That means me, body and mind and Martin, constantly having to negotiate with you lot, with others. What I take myself to be hitting up against, negotiating with, interacting with, coming up against all that I don't take myself not to be. Our life is a series of irritations of relating between who I am and who I'm not. Does that make sense? All our problems in life could be described in that way.
No joy.
There's no problem in it. There's no problem. Is that clear? No, probably not. Joy, not necessarily. I mean, there's a joy that can come, that can be of another order altogether. But we're not, when there's real joy in life, we don't stop to agonize. Oh, I'm having lots of joy. What should I do about it? No? What we're interested in is the problems of life and the way we get into a mess with them. So all our problems in life, I'm saying, can be described by the impact between who I am and who I'm not, who I think I am and who I think I'm not. Our joys may be the hitting up against who I am and who I think I'm not as well. Is that what you mean? Yeah. But in that case, they're rather tarnished joys, I would say. Tarnished means spoiled. Not very good ones. Like tarnished means with when silver has gone dull, or when fruit has got a plum that's been dropped on the floor. It's been spoiled. What's joy spoilt by when it's the joy of one thing hitting up against another? Doesn't have to be in that rather graphic way, but you get the point. It's tarnished by the... There's a background anxiety, I would say. That's always there. Explain more clearly. I don't like to get too much into abstract situations, but I'm not managing to avoid them. So name a joy.
Love.
Okay, a bit more specific. Because love doesn't have to have anything to do. I mean, actually, love is the absence of one thing hitting up against another. So love doesn't have to have anything at all to do with, thank God, with who I am, who I think I am. In fact, when love is truly present, there's an absence of identification. Two people. When there's the strongest, most beautiful sense of love is characterized very clearly by the absence of a sense of me and you as strong, rigid, separate things. No? So that's why I say, when you say "and our joy," no, not really. The greatest beauty in life is characterized by the absence of self and other. Love is the dissolution of the best. I feel love is nice, but it's very limited still. True. The real love doesn't need an object and a subject to muck things up. You understand what I mean by that? Love is very problematic when in trying to negotiate between an object and a subject. It also keeps other things keep getting in the way between that object and subject. I spoke about this the other night a bit. Huh? Sometimes between I who feel love for somebody, then they go and drop my cup, and I say, "Oh, you stupid," and I don't feel love anymore. Changes. Oh, it's not me. Okay. It'll improve. I'm saying never mind, it's not too bad. All the while, there's something we're relating everything to, there's something we're having to defend. So even if what we're feeling is love, I feel love. It's like, oh, I feel love. Fantastic. Instead of those other things that are lurking behind. And however much I feel love, however deeply I feel love, however fully I feel love, however wide that love that I feel is, what happens? It changes, it disappears, and something else comes in, and then I feel something else. And so then I say, oh, that love was so good. I want to feel that love again. I don't want to feel that other stuff. And we're in the same realm of I negotiating with the world. I negotiating with self, other, and environment. You know? In terms of what I want, how I want to be, how I want you to be, and how I want life to be. So this whole realm, whether we talk about problems, joys, love, anything, all the while I identify with something as who I am, that thing that I identify with, whether it's my mind, whether it's my body, whether it's larger than my body, which I'll talk about in a sec, we're always having to defend that. It's a process that's bound to agitation, bound to defensiveness, bound up with protection. Sometimes we identify with even larger than ourselves. We put the sense of self, of who I am or who we are, into a group of people. Us and them. And we actually feel like there's some bond between us, and that we would live or die for these other people, my family, my country, my culture. The people I identify with means the people I take as being us. And again, even though we wouldn't say that we're kind of joined at the hip, there's some underlying sense that this is who we are, and that I identify myself with, I believe in an identity with those people. That again, that identity, to the extent I identify with it, to that extent I need to defend it against real or imagined attacks from others. In the same way, if I identify with self as body and mind, whether the feelings are wonderful or not, I'm still having to defend against, I'm having to defend that sense of self against others. And so when I take myself to be anything, when somebody else threatens that sense, it hurts. Or when I myself can't marry my self-image and the evidence, it hurts. Oh dear, so many hands. I really like to take questions in talks. I like to feel that if I'm speaking, it's responding to the places of real interest there, rather than just me spouting off. But I'm a little wary. What I wouldn't like to happen is that we go off into a kind of abstract debate, because it doesn't really help us. This is difficult subject matter. And the idea is not that we fabricate a bunch of ideas, but that we look and see as much as possible in our own hearts and our own being, what's happening in my relationship to who I think I am? And is it in line with what's being said? Is there anything in my life in which I'm identifying with or defending a sense of self that's causing me pain? If there isn't, lucky you, please come and sit up here. And I'll get down there. If there is, then this is an invitation to us to see what that might be, because there's a possibility in it of another way of being, where we're not needing to identify and we're not needing to defend. We're not needing to keep life at bay. We're not needing to be doubtful of ourselves and others in terms of who we are. And we're able to rest in the true nature of who we are. The way being is. The Buddha said, from complete and unexcelled enlightenment, understand the words? Unexcelled means unsurpassed, best. From complete and unexcelled enlightenment, I gained absolutely nothing. Busy in the business of trying to gain things might strike us as a bit worrying. From complete and unexcelled enlightenment means from the great liberation, from understanding, embodying and living the ultimate freedom of being, I gained absolutely nothing. And this practice is not about improving oneself. It's not about perfecting oneself. It's about the complete and utter deconstruction of anything we identify with, until all that's left is either absolutely everything or absolutely nothing. Which have a sweet way of turning out to be the same thing. Peter teacher who lived in Bombay in India and died about 20 years ago, I think now, has this beautiful line. If you want one line to contemplate for years and years, I would thoroughly recommend this one. I feel, with no exaggeration, I feel I've been contemplating this line for 15 years and that I'm still getting insight out of it. That's a big build-up, I know. Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. Between these two, my life flows. Tells me I am nothing. Means them. If I really investigate the tendency to identify with body, the tendency to identify with mind, the tendency to identify with thought, that identification starts to get shaken up. Where is the sense of self apart from the thought about it? Who am I prior to the I thought? Anything I can take myself to be is known. If it's known, it can't be who I am. It's being known. Is that you understand when I say that? It's very difficult, but it's brilliant. I can recognize my body. I can recognize thoughts. I can recognize feelings. I can recognize perceptions. I can recognize even the thought, I. I am Martin. But that thought's recognized. What's recognizing it? So, well, it must be me. I'm recognizing it. But that recognition is known. So it can't be who I am. Who I am is always known. So what's doing the knowing? There's nothing we can find. I didn't say there's nothing here, but there's nothing we can find. There's nothing we can hang eye on that can hold up.
Maybe you can say that the recognizer is kind of the eye. Let's say like
a... could say that. We could say anything. But wisdom tells me, Nisargadatta says, wisdom tells me, it means the deepest investigation I'm able to give shows that there's knowing. Every single part of my being is known as an object. Body, if it's being known, anything that's known, that's seen, that's recognized, is an object, not the subject. Body is known. Feelings are known. Thoughts are known. The sense of I is known. Anywhere I place my attention, anything I've taken myself to be can be known. This is not in the realm of good ideas. This is the revolutionary work, the revolutionary practice, the revolutionary opportunity of examining our life ruthlessly, radically, ultimately. Nothing I can find can be held onto as who I am. Everything I can find is known, is recognized. Wisdom tells me I'm nothing. But that's my heart tells me, and we spoke about this the other night, the unbounded heart, that which is all included. Stars find their place in my sense of being. Love tells me I'm everything. Universe and self and you and me and this and that all arise somehow together in a way that is, again, not in the realms of ideas, but in the realms of when our being receives all of that, our sense is of being everything that binds all that together is love. Love tells me I'm everything. It tells me I'm nothing. Therein is the paradox that poor old mind can't understand. Nisargadatta doesn't even lose in this paradox. Unfolds in this paradox. Nisargadatta translates as Mr. Natural. Naturally. Naturally uncluttered by thinking I'm this or that. Wisdom informs the being. Love informs the being. Being troubled by the seeming paradox. Love informs the being that everything's included. Wisdom informs the being there's nothing here to hold on to cling to identify with. Nothing here that can be held, but a relief when I've spent decades defending who I think I am. Decades trying to build it up. Decades of posturing. Decades of presenting. Decades of defending. Decades of distracting. Decades of working on. What I can cling to that has any I-ness to it. Silence. Is there room for the whisper? Or is there the trying to figure it out? If there is, please let go of it. Freedom. And everything being included, love is the natural response for the deep benefit of ourselves and of all beings. Time of inviting this precious silence. Nothing to change when the retreat ends tomorrow. So for the remaining hours that we have, I'd like to invite you very warmly to listen as deeply as you can to the whisper of silence. We find that silence and spaciousness within or without, or whether the boundary between the two starts to seem less important. Silence and spaciousness doesn't need the clumsy description of inner and outer. Use of the time that we have left. Stretching your legs if you need to, and then we'll have a short meditation together, which will be out there, you know? Lying down under the stars, sitting up if you have to, and just to find a space somewhere where you can be comfortable to meet the universe. Okay. Thank you.